My sole goal as an educator is not teaching you what to think, because if that happens, I'm just making for a very well-spoken parrot.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Radio Lab 201, the podcast coming out of the computer lab at Benjamin Franklin High School. Today, I have an interesting guest, my colleague, Jason Klicker, and I got him here because of something he wrote recently that made me really stop and take a second look. But before that, let me introduce Mr. Klicker. He has been in this school teaching for how many years, Jason?
This will be my fifth year teaching, almost on number six.
Okay, so welcome, Jason, to this podcast. I've always wanted to have you on this, but I couldn't think of a topic that would be perfect for you. But now I think I have three, and we're going to put it all into one. So let's get started. First of all, Jason teaches American history, called AP U.S. History, or APUSH, right?
Yes, APUSH.
And when you look at his syllabus, it's like phenomenal, and the kind of things he touches on. And one of the topics that I've seen on his syllabus was really interesting, and I'm sure my listeners will be interested in this. It's on the Federalist Papers. I think this is a perfect time and a perfect year to talk about this. So can you tell me, how do you approach that topic when you teach students about that?
Well, I approach the Federalist Papers in both my APUSH class and my regular history class the exact same that I try to approach every single topic, where my sole goal as an educator is not teaching you what to think, because if that happens, I'm just making for a very well-spoken parrot. The whole goal of an educator should be to teach a person how to think. So, especially in the APUSH class, we will read a lot of primary source documents. And after we read these primary source documents, we'll have Socratic seminars, where they all gather around my desk in a half semicircle, and we'll discuss some of the big concepts that go on there. One of the ones that we did for the Federalist Papers, especially in Federalist Paper number one, where Hamilton is talking about how they're writing these essays to get people to adopt the Constitution. And he says that one of the reasons we are doing this is because we want to convince people peacefully to adopt the Constitution. We don't want to shove this down your throats because, as he says, and I quote, although this is probably going to be more of a kind of quote, that in politics and religion, you cannot cure a heresy through fire and sword. You cannot force a person to believe in an idea they don't want to. As I always tell my kids, the only way that an idea ever dies is if it commits suicide. You are the only one that is able to get rid of an idea in your brain. And so I need to be able to teach you guys how to rationally discuss ideas so that you can both change your own mind once you get enough facts and also be able to change other people's minds, or at least help them to do so. And the only way you can do that is to critically think. And the best way to critically think is if you discuss a bunch of these heavy concepts with other people.
So this is an interesting way of, I hate to say persuasion, but in a way, making people believe in something without using the big stick, or without persuading, like through PR or advertising or the modern forms of communication that we have. What I find interesting about this is these are papers, and this was what you might think of as a literary society or a social milieu in which people did a lot of reading to understand. So were they expecting these papers to be in popular culture at that time read by people?
Yes. The whole entire reason they're writing the Federalist Papers in the first place is because the first form of government that America had after the Revolutionary War was not very good at all. It was called the Articles of Confederation, and it left a lot to be desired. The Founding Fathers had come up with the Constitution, but it gave much more power to the government than the Articles had. In early colonial America, and extending well into early American history, every single family had several books that they always had. Just about every single family in colonial New England had the Christian Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. Those were two books that you could find in almost every single home. And so there was definitely a literary emphasis that was placed in that society. So when Hamilton and James Madison are trying to get the new American nation to adopt their constitution, they realize the best way to get them to do this, not through deceit or persuasion, to get them to do it because they wanted to do it, they had them read a bunch of letters that they published in the New York Times that were eventually called the Federalist Papers. They did this for weeks and weeks, and every single week they had willing readers who were ready to tackle these very complex subjects that they were discussing. And that's what I'm trying to do with my class as well, that we are able to talk about what it means to be a just person one week. And then the very next week, we can go into discussing what is a just foreign policy for the United States of America to have, because we just learned about justice the last week.
Okay, now, one thing struck me, you said this was published 234 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
That long?
Oh, yes.
There were newspapers like the Times?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That was the way that American colonials used to communicate with one another, because they were too far away for day trips, and the road system back then was absolutely awful. And so what you would do is you would have the ships going from harbor to harbor and then spreading out locally on land. And so you would have these massive newspaper publications that would be spread all over the state or the colony in the early days.
As you can see why I'm interested in this, my elective is on writing and publishing in the digital age, and we're talking about the analog age, and we're still fascinated by print on paper. Now, I want to just dovetail into this idea of what you do in opening ceremony. For those of you who haven't heard, you know, we do every day, a teacher gives an address to the students. We used to do it live in the gym. Right now we're doing it online. But it's a fabulous moment in the morning where we hear a teacher weigh in on an important topic related to one of
The virtues of virtues of the month.
The virtues of the month, yes. So we have a virtue each month, and the teacher expounds on that. And Jason, every few weeks, he comes on, and it's like listening to a great orator, and I love to hear him.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So I want to ask you, what was one of your favorite topics that you spoke on?
Well, you know, every single month we do a different Roman virtue, and so oftentimes we think of that as a topic, but we're not doing these virtues just because we need something to fill the air, that we need something to distract our kids for 20 minutes every day. We're doing this because we're trying to get them to pursue truth, and we think that this is the best way to do it. So when we're talking about topics, I think that my favorite topic would be something that I can talk about almost universally, no matter what virtue and no matter what month it may happen to be. And I think that the favorite topic that I like to talk about is hope. I love talking about hope and positivity in opening ceremonies, especially right at the start of their day, before the grime of all those hours of schooling has collected on them.
The grime of school. Isn't that a wonderful, gritty expression about what happens sometimes in school? But I got Jason to explain how he approaches a topic, and it's funny how he brings in Legos and turns it into a philosophical observation about students in general and about life.
My nephew's 6th birthday was last week, and it was a lovely birthday that I couldn't attend because I had to teach. They live in Ohio. And so on this Zoom call, I was sitting there watching him open all of his presents. My wife and I got him the game Hungry Hungry Hippos, which he absolutely loved. But easily, his favorite thing that he got was a Lego Star Wars set. Hmm. Oh, he loves Legos. He loves Star Wars. It was a match made in heaven. And he had to show Uncle Jason what he was doing. So he brings it right over in front of the laptop that they had broadcasting into their living room, and he's assembling it with his dad, and you can just see his face light up as he does this. And then all of a sudden, as he's finished and he's holding it aloft and he's dancing like crazy, he drops the thing because he's 6 years old. He's very clumsy, and I can't hear the shattering of the Legos on the ground, but I can see it in his dad's face. What has just happened, this thing that they have spent the last 20 minutes working on, is now scattered all over their living room floor. And my nephew is 6 years old, so I know that the tantrum is about to come.
So the show and tell ends.
Oh, yeah, the show and tell ends. And I'm waiting for this. I see his face, and I see the tears well up, and then all of a sudden, he gets very calm. And he shrugs, and I see him start to reach down to pick up his Legos. And I look at him, and I go, oh, buddy, I'm so sorry. Are you okay? And he looked back at the camera. He just shrugged at me, and he said, it's okay. Not broken, just messy. And for some reason, well after that Zoom call had ended, I could not get the phrase, not broken, just messy, out of my head. And how much better things would be if everyone thought like this. And one of the reasons why I love talking about opening ceremonies so much is because you can find these universal truths and these principles that we're talking about in just about every single facet of your life, if you're looking for them. And so when we are talking about hope and happiness, how often do we feel that our life may be broken, that we've done something that is beyond repair, that something has happened to us and we think to ourselves, well, this is the way that my life will be. This is what fate has decided for me. And if we're thinking this, how often must our kids who are growing up in very contentious times think that either the world around them or maybe they themselves are broken? And I just want to say to them what my nephew said to me, you know, not broken, just messy. Messes can be cleaned up. Messes can be fixed. Messes may be made better than they originally were in the future. It just may take some time. And so next month when I do opening ceremonies again, it will be the Roman virtue of felicitas, or happiness. And I think that the quote of the week being not broken, just messy, is a fantastic quote to have for happiness, to make you realize that you are indeed not broken, just messy.
Out of the mouths of babes or kids. Interesting, which makes me want to think about Stanley Milgram. I happen to know Milgram because of his small world theory and his 6 degrees of separation. I know a little bit about obedience theory, but you gave a deep insight into it. First of all, this is social psychology. You're a history teacher. How on earth did you come across this story and make it relevant to the piece that you wrote?
The reason I came across this story is because I like to read a lot from a bunch of different places, just because I love having as much knowledge as possible. One of my professors in college once said to me that to a hammer, everything will look like a nail. So you need to make sure that your field of knowledge isn't so narrow that you become a hammer. To a historian, everything will have a history problem. To a chemist, everything comes down to chemistry. So you need to be able to see things as both a historian and a chemist. You can have varying levels of expertise in these things. You will naturally be inclined to some, but you need to look as far as possible. And I found this obedience experiment that Stanley Milgram had done in the early 1960s. He was very interested in the Nazi guards after World War II who worked in these concentration camps and said that the only reason they had done such awful, evil things was because they were, quote, following orders. And he was blown away by this. How in the world could you commit such evil while just simply following orders? And so he designed an experiment where he had an actor that he had hired who was supposed to give memory repetition answers. And if the actor got the questions wrong, the actual person who is being experimented on was supposed to deliver a shock to them, which would get up to 400 volts, which is not exactly a tickle when it comes to electricity. They were supposed to administer a shock. If the actor got the question wrong, which they did on purpose many times, and the actor would convincingly fake scream, as if they were actually being electrocuted. At no point in time were they forced to be there. They were simply given orders in a cascading series of severity. If they refused for some reason, because some of them felt uneasy, they were given a series of 4 orders, 4 prompts if they kept on refusing. The first prompt was please continue. Or sometimes he would say, please go on. I heard you listening to the audio as I came in today, and it's quite startling to almost hear the mindlessness that people were doing this in. The second prompt they gave was, the experiment requires that you continue. Prompt number three, if they still refuse at this point in time, was, it is absolutely essential that you continue. And then prompt number four was, you have no other choice. You must continue. A full two-thirds of those who participated in this experiment administered the maximum shock of 400 volts that they thought another human being was getting. And 100% of the people involved in this experiment administered a shock of 300 volts, the second highest severity. So every single person followed the prompt that said, it is absolutely essential to continue. And two-thirds of those people, only because they were ordered to, because they were told, you have no other choice, you must continue, they inflicted harm upon another human being.
Even though they were not coerced into doing it, they just felt like they just had to follow.
They had to follow orders.
Now, the interesting thing is, this was done at Yale, and this was done with possibly students, and they were more or less volunteers. I believe they were paid a small stipend for it. So, in a sense, they had every reason why they could have backed out, correct?
Absolutely.
They were not getting a grade for this. So they
No incentive for them to continue. They weren't being rewarded for administering a higher level of shock.
Right, and this was not an authority figure like we think of authoritarian figures. This was just a lab, a researcher, and of course, he put on a good show. From what I understand, it was a big stage set up. The room was set up, the actors were set up, but they could have at any point backed up, and they didn't. So what does that mean for education and for
students? What does it mean for us? So I call people like this, the people who follow orders because they are simply orders, I like to call them Milgramites, followers of this little idea that Stanley Milgram had. And it's scary because you are seeing many, many people who are doing truly awful things. And what is most scary to me is that they don't understand that they're evil. At least if a person commits an evil act and understands the evilness, I can accept that. We can work with this. We can have a discussion and a dialogue, and I can convince them it's wrong. But if you don't think it's wrong in the first place, any appeal to morality is lost on you. And a lot of horrible atrocities have been committed because of this. And so it is absolutely essential that I, as a teacher, teach my kids to critically think about this and other things. When that final prompt says, you have no choice, you must continue, it is imperative that I, as a teacher, tell my students, you always have a choice. There is always such a thing as good and evil out there. And a lot of times I won't be there to tell you which one is which. You have to come up with this on your own. You have to have the critical thinking skills necessary already to make these connections, to stand up for what you believe in, because these beliefs are your own, not just ones that you've copied from someone else. Because if there's someone else's beliefs that you have chosen to pick, you'll drop those at the first sign of trouble. You have to believe in what you believe with all of your heart.
In one sense, this comes back to the topic we started off with, right? The Federalist Papers, because Hamilton and
Madison,
and who's the third person, by the way?
John Jay, but he only wrote five of the Federalist Papers. It was Hamilton and Madison who carried the brunt of the load.
So, in a sense, they were getting people to understand how to think, not what to think, right?
It's amazing how all of these things from across different time periods will all reflect back to those same eternal truths. It's funny how that happens.
Funny how that happens, and that shows that there is that such a thing as the eternal truth, and there is such a thing as good and evil, and I find that super interesting because, you know, even in a computer lab, even if you're teaching math, I guess there has to be absolutes. Otherwise, it's going to be the slippery slope.
If there are no absolutes, then why do we care if kids misbehave? It might not be fine to us, but maybe it's fine to them. If there's no absolute truth, then what's the point of anything we're teaching them? There has to be these objective sources of truth, goodness, and beauty. Otherwise, what we live for really isn't that important, or it may end up not being important if it's decided on at a future time and place.
And that's, I suppose, what the classical model is all about, right?
It is all about that.
On this note, I think I must bring this to a close. We can go on because there's so much to talk about with Jason. But thank you for being on the show, Jason, and thank you for the insight.
Thank you for having me.
And on that note, thank you for listening. This is your host, Angelo Fernandez, signing off. Catch these podcasts on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts. Or you can also find versions of this on medium.com, where we post a narrative of these podcasts and other stories.